Let's change up the way you watch baseball. Introducing Change Up, a brand new live whip-around show across the league, brought to you by MLB and DAZN. Jump in and out of the best plays as they happen and get expert analysis from hosts who bring a fresh personality and new perspective to the game. It's on every night and available on nearly any device, smart TVs, tablet, mobile, and gaming consoles. Getting set up with DAZN is easy. Just download the DAZN app in the Apple or Android App Store, sign up by creating an account, and then start watching across any of your devices. That's DAZN. Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB show. My name is Michael Bauman and I am a staff writer at the Ringer. We've got a lot to talk about this week, so let's get right to it with Zach Cram. All right, so our first segment was supposed to be about the Boston Red Sox, who have started 3-8. But as we were bantering before the segment, Zach Cram, who is our self-appointed Red Sox expert, revealed that he had, one, never seen Major League until recently, and two, hated it. So, Zach, I'm interested to hear your explanation.
I think we should just move on, leave the banter where the banter is and talk about Boston right now.
Okay, so you can't defend this position is what I'm
completely understand. I'm in the minority. I'd much rather watch a dozen other baseball movies again rather than Major League a second time, let alone Major League Part 2.
What is your number one baseball movie?
Either A League of Their Own, which is fantastic and funny, mm-hmm. and much more charming than Major League, or A Little Big League.
Little Big League is
Billy
the
Haywood
correct answer.
Was, a lot of people when their kids want to be like Ken Griffey Jr. when they grow up, I wanted to be Billy Haywood.
I think that is, so Little Big League, I think I've told this story or said this before. There were two movies that I saw when I was a kid that were like what I wanted to be when I grew up, or like showed children in jobs that I thought it would be cool to have. One was Little Big League. The other was Red Dawn. So when I grew up, I wanted to either be a big league manager or a Mujahideen. That's I've always loved Little Big League. Everybody Wants Some would probably be number one, if not for Little Big League. I listened to the entire The Natural rewatchables with my hands balled into fists because they were saying The Natural was the best baseball movie ever. Natural's not that good.
The 90s were the real heyday.
It's true. And I'm not really sure why that is. So this was years ago, back when I was at Baseball Prospectus, but I wrote about like the golden age of baseball movies and like the overlapping actors who had been in multiple films. Like there are some actors whose entire career is just based on they could play a baseball player convincingly in the 90s. One thing that it's so hard to do convincing baseball action on TV and film. And one thing that is great about Little Big League is so many of the baseball players are actually baseball players, or they're played by guys who either were MLB players or played in college or played in the minor leagues. Like Scott Patterson, who went on to play Luke in Gilmore Girls, pitched up to AAA for the Braves. He was the one of the Twins pitchers in that movie. And Jonathan Silverman out of nowhere is like one of three convincing actor non-baseball players to actually get some of the actions of pitching right. It's a really tough thing to do, and I think that's one underrated reason why Little Big League is so great.
It's kind of like the movie Miracle, where instead of casting actors and making
exactly
them learn
right.
how to play hockey, they just cast hockey players and taught them how to act.
Yep. And successfully in some cases and unsuccessfully in other cases, I could say, as someone who loves Miracle. Anyway, what we're going to talk about is the Boston Red Sox, who were number two in my preseason power rankings. They're a team that I expect to I expected them to win the American League East. I know you didn't, at the risk of dragging that up again. But I think everybody expected them to be good. They won the World Series. They won 108 games last year. They brought the whole band back, and they're 3-8 and going for 4-8 as we speak. So you have seen Chris Sale today. How does he look?
Well, he looks better than last time, where he was sitting at 89 miles an hour with his fastball. Today, we're talking right now in the second inning, and he's been averaging about 92. So that's three ticks better than last time. It's still three ticks below what he usually averages. His previous season averages are about 95, 96 miles an hour. So I think that's a concern. Alex Cora came out this morning and said that he thought Chris Sale's velocity was down, especially last time, because he had been ill. Cora told MassLive.com, and I'm going to quote here, "He spent a lot of time in the bathroom. Yeah, let's put it that way." So I guess it's a good thing Cora didn't go into further detail there, and maybe it's understandable why Sale's velocity was down. The Red Sox talked a lot in spring training about being more careful with his workload and his velocity early in the season, mm-hmm. because Sale has rather notoriously suffered in the second half, both last year when he actually had shoulder injuries, and even before that, he just seemed to fatigue a little bit as the season wore on. So I'm not as concerned as I was even half an hour ago, now that I've seen that he can still reach the 90s again. But I think that's where Boston's concerns start, when you have probably the best pitcher in the league throwing, he's the best strikeout pitcher of all time, and he's not getting any whiffs.
So there are three plausible explanations that I've seen. One is that he's trying to preserve himself for down the stretch. And one that's sort of related, that Alex Spire of the Boston Globe wrote about. I really like this article. You know, he used like release point data to show that he's not extending, which maybe means he's not exerting himself as much. Maybe he's trying to take a little bit off and be sharper for the playoffs. And now Alex Cora says he was sick last time out. I would buy any one of those on its own, but the fact that we're being served up all three at once worries me a little bit. Am I being a little paranoid?
No, I think that makes sense, but I'd also say that like Chris Sale's struggles alone are not the reason that Boston is 3-8. Their entire starting rotation has been abysmal. They have a cumulative ERA of 8.57 heading into today. And here's some analysis for you. If the starting rotation continues to allow a run every single inning, Boston's not going to repeat as division champs. But I don't think anybody expects that to happen. Like right now, the Red Sox, including the relievers who have actually been pretty solid, are averaging over 2 home runs per game. That's, by far the worst in Major League history over a full season. So we can probably expect that they're not going to start allowing so many home runs. And I think that any sort of panic right now should be focused more on like, all right, is this star, no longer at his previous level, rather than just like the whole team is in a mess.
Yeah. The systemic failure of the starting rotation, it's not quite like what's going on with the Cubs. This feels a little more fluky because I wouldn't necessarily expect Rick Porcello to suddenly fall off a cliff, for instance, whereas there were signs, worrying signs about some of the Cubs pitchers. Although at the same time, like Nathan Eovaldi is what he is. Eduardo Rodriguez is struggling to throw strikes, and this is not an alien concern. So do they need to make a move? Do they need to do anything to fix this? Or if they ride it out, is this going to be better by the end of the month?
Yeah, I think I was in my mind comparing them to the Cubs as well, and I'm not as concerned. What's interesting is that what were we all saying about Boston over the offseason? Like, what are they doing with their bullpen, right? They lost mm-hmm. Craig Kimbrell. They lost, Joe Kelly, who hasn't started off so hot this year.
They
with
might
the
be better off.
But their bullpen's been just fine. Ryan Brazier and Matt Barnes have yet to allow a run. And I don't know if I expect the bullpen to continue to be good, but that's not the problem thus far. And they actually invested in the rotation. They signed Nathan Eovaldi to, 4 years, $68 million. Mm-hmm. So, that was maybe a little bit of an overpay for a World Series hero, which I think we all understood. But it's not like all five of these starters are questionable, like maybe some of the Cubs' arms are. I would expect them to round into shape. And again, like today's the first Red Sox home game of the season. Maybe there were just some weirdness by starting on a long road trip and, starting the season off against the indefatigable Seattle Mariners maybe just ruined them for that whole road trip because
they're snatcher.
Yeah. After you face the juggernaut Seattle offense, you're going to be in a funk for a week.
One other thing that I think might be making things look worse than they are is you go up and down the lineup, like, and not to belabor the Cubs comparison, but the Cubs are hitting fine. Everybody is sort of doing what they're expected to do. Apart from really Xander Bogaerts and JD Martinez, and I don't know how to project Mitch Moreland at this point in his career. everybody in Boston's lineup is just sort of getting off to a slow start. And they've had, you know, Brock Holt on the DL. Dustin Pedroia is just now making his return from what baseball reference calls a, quote, problematic left knee, which is a hilarious way to phrase, it makes it sound like his knee was had accidentally sent DMs out on its main Twitter feed. Anyway, I don't know if that joke landed or not. I apologize. With Pedroia back, Brock Holt's going to be back before too long. Mookie Betts has been good. He'll turn back into Mookie Betts eventually. I have confidence that this offense is going to come around.
I have a question. When you say he'll turn back into Mookie Betts eventually, what do you think that looks like at the plate? Because we've had a run of a couple seasons now where somebody either approaches Trout or even perhaps exceeds him in production and then sort of falls back, not to earth the next season, but falls back to sub-Troutian levels. We had Bryce Harper in 2015. We had Jose Altuve in 2017. And now we have Betts, where if you look at Betts' offensive track record, I know he made some swing changes last year, and that, I think, allowed him to access more power. But his WRC plus last year was 185, which meant he was 85% better at the plate than league average. Before that, his career high was 136. So I think it's probably more likely that look like Mookie Betts again is just in like the 140 to 150 range, where that's still really good.
Still better than what he's doing now.
Sure, but I don't think we can expect him to produce really similar numbers to what
hit
he did
346
last year.
Again. Yeah.
Maybe that's like a hot take after an off season of people basically bunching Trout and Betts together. But I think the analytical industry at large has maybe become a little too comfortable with placing people on Trout's level. When really what makes Trout tremendous isn't just how good he is at his peak, but how he does it every single month, every single year.
Yeah. And that's a fair point. And I maybe don't expect him to hit as well as he did last year. But the other thing is, like, he's put up those, and a lot of this is defense, I'll admit, but he's put up like close to 10 win seasons twice. And if you look at Altuve and Donaldson and Bryce Harper, maybe Harper didn't look at like this at the time, but those seasons were one-offs, and you know, they looked like the career year. And you know, Betts has done it more than once now, put up like an actual challenge to Trout as the best player in a given season. So I don't expect him, you know, by no means do I expect him to continue to be as good as Trout, but I think that we can look at what he did last year as something that, you know, as the product of building on his development. You know, he's also younger than Altuve and Donaldson were when they had their MVP seasons. And he's got, I don't know, more so than Donaldson, maybe I'm overstating the ways in which he's different from Altuve in this respect, but you know, his bat to ball ability, his strength in his hands and his wrists, that I think gives him a lot of room to fail as a player. Although, you know, he's hitting 262, 333, 476 heading into today. I'd expect those offensive numbers, to tick up, you know, maybe not up to the 180 WRC plus level of last year, but I think he's still got room to improve this season.
Yeah, to be clear, I think Mookie Betts will probably be a perennial all-star going forward, could contend for more MVPs.
He is a perennial all-star. He's made it 3 years in a row.
But I think, you know, expecting him alone to save the offense by returning to last year's levels is maybe a quixotic dream. Do you think that the start has changed your actual opinion of Boston's team so far, or do you just chalk it up to a random 10-game sample? I know Ben sent over this morning as we were preparing that since the start of the season, Boston's odds of making the division series have dropped by nearly 20 percentage points, and Tampa's have risen by nearly 20 percentage points because, you know, even if you think Boston's still better going forward, that is a five-game gap. Does that account, you know, factor into your mind at all?
I mean, it's not great, but let me answer it this way. Ben and I have actually already recorded the segment that's going to go after this, where we talk about things that we might have been wrong about, or things that we thought might go wrong for certain teams or well for certain teams and have just been more extreme than we anticipated. We didn't really talk about the Red Sox. I think they are still a true talent 100-win team. I still think they're going to win the AL East. I think they're, this is not the Cubs where I'm worried about them long term, or, you know, the Nationals bullpen or the Angels where everybody got hurt, or the Yankees even where everybody's getting hurt. Like, this is still essentially the same team, with the exception of Sale, you know, my not really being sure if Sale is healthy or not. I don't really see any reason to adjust my preseason perception. I think that the 5-game hole, you know, the Rays are good. I think the Red Sox are more than 5 games better than the Rays from now until the end of the season.
Yeah, and I think the Yankees comparison is a useful one, because you look at Boston, the concern is, well, Chris Sale might be hampered. The Yankees ace has been out.
Yeah,
and
we know Severino's hurt. We know Aaron Hicks is hurt. We know, you know, 7 other people are hurt out of that lineup. And, you know, that's something that can happen in the first week of the season that actually should change your opinion of what a team is capable of doing, because the composition of the team is changing. You know, we talk about Justin Upton's injury, for instance. Like, if a contending team loses a guy in the last week of spring training or the first week of the season, yeah, you absolutely should change your opinion of what that team's capable of. But I don't, you know, I don't see a reason to really move the needle that much on Boston. Not yet, at least. And maybe we talk in 2 or 3 weeks and that changes, but.
Yeah. And just with Severino, he's going back to New York to get another MRI on his shoulder because he felt, I guess, uncomfortable during a long toss session. So things could look even worse. I think, even though their record looks bad and even though their starting pitching has been torched for 11 straight games, I might rather have Boston start than New York's, just because they haven't received those like longer term shocks to the roster. And also, like, the Yankees are 5-5 right now. They lost a game their bullpen blew in Houston last night, but they started off their season with probably the easiest schedule in the majors, and they lost a series to Baltimore. They lost a series to the Tigers. So, like, is Boston going into Oakland and losing a series worse than the Yankees basically starting off 500 with that schedule? I'm not really sure. And of course, over the rest of the season, those schedules will even out. So I think if you're New York, you're kind of made more okay with your start, because at least Boston isn't running away with it, and you're Boston, sort of vice versa as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I said this about when the Astros started 1-3 and Boston going into Oakland losing 3 or 4. Like, that's going to happen. You go on the road to good teams, you're going to lose the series most of the time, no matter who you are. So the fact that there's no, you know, 2 months of winning record to dilute that, the impact of a series loss on the standings, I think makes it look a little bit worse than it is. Now, I would not say the same about losing 3 or 4 to Seattle, all due respect to Seattle or Arizona. But we're just real quick before... as we're talking about injuries that might change your perception of a contending team, I think we should circle back to something we were talking about last week, because Mike Clevinger, the Indians right-hander, is on the shelf. He's not going to pick up a ball for 6 to 8 weeks because of a back injury. And now Cleveland was sort of skating by with four really good starting pitchers and 2, you know, top 10 in the AL position players, and hoping that was going to be enough. And they're now down one of those starters, and one of their 2 key position players is out for, still out for a significant period of time. And they're still right in the mix. Like, their record is not worrisome at all. But their roster comps, like, they're really showcasing how thin that team is. And I'm wondering if Clevinger's injury moves a needle for you.
I think it does a little bit, just because I don't think Clevinger's injury by itself means that, you know, Cleveland isn't any longer the favorite, but I think it just increases the risk, sort of like what's been happening with the Yankees infield. Like, the fact that Miguel Andujar is hurt isn't huge because of the drop off to DJ LeMahieu, who I think is a pretty good player, but it just means that if another guy gets hurt, then it's a much bigger drop down. And that's what happened when Tulowitzki got hurt the next day. So now Clevinger's hurt. Well, what happens if Corey Kluber needs to spend 2 weeks on the DL? You know, what happens if a freak line drive hits Trevor Bauer again and he has to miss a month? And I think that's where Cleveland has sort of been flirting with all of this risk potential. Ryan Lewis from the Akron Beacon Journal tweeted today with the Clevenger news that with Clevenger out for up to 2 months, along with Adam Plutko and others at AAA dealing with their own rehabs, there's much to figure out beyond just this weekend. First of all, the fact that they're going to, you know, Adam Plutko is in and of itself perhaps a problem, but that the fact that those guys are also injured just shows that it's a much bigger problem than just filling his spot.
It's very similar to the way I would describe it. And I talked about the Yankees when I did my Should You Panic piece, that, you know, the Yankees have incredible, and the Yankees and Indians both have breathing room. The Yankees because of their depth, the Indians because of how dog shit the rest of the division is. And they're not in trouble. Neither team is in trouble because of these injuries, but they've used up a lot of that breathing room, like you said. So, like, the Yankees are pretty much out of major league quality position players right now. They need to start getting guys back. And Cleveland is, you know, I'm not worried about the Tigers starting 7-3, for instance, and I'm not that worried about Clevenger, but what, you know, what happens if the Twins sign Dallas Keuchel and he comes back and suddenly that rotation looks, and, you know, all of a sudden there's an actual number two starter behind Jose Barrios. What if this is the year that Michael Pineda stays healthy? And what if this is the year that Byron Buxton puts it all, you know, finally remembers how to hit, you know? So they're at risk, I think, because of the injuries they've suffered this year. But there's a difference between being at risk and in trouble.
The Twins should sign Dallas Keuchel, by the way.
14 different teams should sign Dallas Keuchel. Like, the number of teams that have run into just obvious roadblocks this season, just in the first couple of weeks, I mean, like, wow, it'd be nice if they had another quality starting pitcher right now, or Craig Kimbrell, or like even Denard Span. I mean, like, would the Indians be better off if they, you know, pulled Denard Span off the street right now? Like, they might. So it's confusing. I don't know if this is the result of those, and not to go back to this thing we spend all off season on, but I don't know if these players and their agents are just waiting around trying to find the right offer, but it's not, you know, it's not for lack of need that these guys are still out there.
I will note, as we wrap up our segment, Chris Sale just allowed 2 runs to Toronto.
Oh boy.
So it's okay. In 3 innings, he's allowed 2 runs and it's lowered his ERA for the season. Yikes.
Is that okay? You sure that's okay? Fastball between 90 and 92. So, well, we will be monitoring Chris Sale's fastball velocity and indeed all baseball stories going forward. And next week, I'm sure we'll talk about Cleveland's lack of depth again. But until then, thanks for joining me.
Until next time.
Hiring is challenging, but there's one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. Place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/RingerMLB. ZipRecruiter sends your job to more than 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/RingerMLB. That's ZipRecruiter.com/RingerMLB. ZipRecruiter.com/RingerMLB. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So this next segment comes to us courtesy of a Twitter user named Chris Haneke, who demanded that we talk about the Seattle Mariners for about 20 minutes, because what's going on isn't funny anymore. And if there's one rule we live by here at the Ringer MLB show, it is, if you request Freebird, we play Freebird. So in the interest of talking about the Mariners, I am pleased to welcome back to the show Fangraphs editor Meg Rowley.
Hi. It's been a little while.
Yeah, it has. It's been since the last time the Mariners were good, I think, if not longer. So yeah. What the hell's going on up there?
I mean, we should be clear that, like, the Mariners are not actually good. I'm going to dispel that bit of business. I mean, this appears to be the ultimate in small sample kind of funkiness, and that doesn't mean we can't enjoy it. It's still quite fun in its way, but this Mariners team is living and breathing the long ball, and that's about it. I went to a Mariners game, my first like in-person game at what is now T-Mobile Park. And there came a moment in the game as where Scott Servais had to turn to the bullpen, as managers are wont to do. And I struggled to think who's going to come in to close out this Mariners game, because it's not Hunter Strickland anymore. So they're just a very funny bit of business. And at some point they will stop scoring quite so many runs per game, and then they will be quite bad again. But in the meantime, they are just hitting all the home runs. So it's working out okay.
One thing I find kind of faintly hilarious about this is last year they weren't that good either, but they stayed in the playoffs or the playoff race for a really long time because they outperformed their run differential by 12 games. They're already two games up on their Pythagorean record, yes, after, which would lead me to believe that, you know, that's, if you outperform your Pythagorean record, that means you've got a good bullpen. Isn't that what people usually say?
That is what people usually say. They don't normally mean Anthony Swarzak when they say it, though.
How dare you?
I don't think. I mean, this Mariners team right now is scoring 8.17 runs per game. They are giving up 5. And so I think that, as long as those numbers stay in their sort of general ratio with each other, it's going to be fine. But I don't expect that, for instance, the Mariners will continue to lead baseball in team WRC plus. Their team WRC plus is 168 right now. Daniel Vogelbach has decided to, now that he is free of prospect eligibility, lead baseball in average exit velocity. That seems unlikely to sustain itself. Daniel Vogelbach has a higher average exit velocity than, say, Joey Gallo, than, say, Aaron Judge, than Nelson Cruz, than Cody Bellinger, who seemingly only hits home runs right now. So I think that's probably going to fade just a smidge at Fangraphs. We still have the Mariners' odds of making the playoffs at a lowly 12.5%, which is behind division mates like the Athletics and the Angels, is behind the Twins, it is behind the Rays. It is ahead of the teams that are worse than them, but they aren't a lot worse. And so, yeah, that's where we are.
I decided to start out being sort of willfully obtuse to give you the opportunity to pump this team up if you wanted to. But I mean, they've had everything go right for them this year, including getting that 2-game head start on the rest of the league and sweeping that series in Japan.
Right.
And so that's had a lot to do with Oakland starting 6-8. The Astros stumbled out of the gate a little bit with a tough opening series in Tampa Bay. And we are obviously early enough in the season that, you know, I almost wonder if it's necessary to give these small sample size caveats, right, in a situation like this, where I feel like everybody knows that anything can happen in the first 2 weeks of the regular season. And if they didn't before, they certainly do now. But in a little bit, I'm going to talk to Ben about things that ways that our perceptions of the season might have changed in the first couple weeks. Has anything changed for you? You know, do you feel like you learned anything, or are you just writing all of this off as a fluke?
Well, it has reinforced for me. This isn't necessarily Mariner specific. You know, I think it has reinforced for me that my aesthetic preference for rebuilds is that they not be so drastic as the ones that we saw the Astros and Cubs effect a couple of years back. You know, there is something to be said for your enjoyment of a baseball team when their reset or step back or what have you results in them, you know, having some players who are youngish and good-ish and sort of competent in some places enough that you're able to sit down and watch a baseball game and not really like hate yourself. And so in that respect, I have learned about my own aesthetic preferences for baseball, which is generally the lens through which I understand baseball anyhow. But no, I don't think so. I will be very anxious to watch how Tim Beckham's season goes. He has this funny thing where he like hits like Barry Bonds for a little bit after he's been traded and then tends to taper off. Often as a result of injury. He has a hammy pull right now. So I'm very curious to see how he sort of sustains himself over the course of this season and what they end up having there. They do have young guys who, you know, if you're looking ahead to the point in the calendar, you know, a couple years from now where they might be ready to compete, you want to see them sustain performance. So it's been encouraging as a person who still ostensibly roots for the Mariners to see that like Mitch Haniger has had a nice start to the season. Kikuchi remains intriguing. intriguing. I never want to watch Ryan Healy play third base ever again, but we'll have to for a number of weeks. That is going as well as could be expected, which is not particularly well. I have also learned, and this is not, I suppose, learning, but so much as having it reinforced, that while the error is not a particularly descriptive stat and is full of funkiness and flukiness, there are times where you watch baseball teams and you're like, oh, these errors are indicative of quite poor defense on the part of the team. And this Mariners team certainly qualifies in that respect. So we've seen some of that. And I think that they are the team that has made everyone sit up and say, so the ball is juiced. Yeah.
That's one thing I was going to talk about. But first, I'm interested to, or it's interesting that you brought them up in contrast to what the Astros did, because I think I'm seeing some things that this year's Mariners are doing that actually remind me of the thing I think that the Astros did best during their rebuild. So it's the focus on tanking is about clearing payroll and getting high draft picks, and all that matters, you know. But what put the Astros over the top is that they gave playing time, like when they were burning the whole building to the ground, they gave playing time to players who either homegrown players who might not have gotten that opportunity, who developed into star level players, or cast offs from other teams. So, you know, players like Jose Altuve and Dallas Keuchel and Marwin Gonzalez and Colin McHugh. And I think the Mariners, having rebuilt their, or being in the process of rebuilding their farm system from nothing, a lot of the new guys they're bringing in are in their mid to late 20s. Guys like Domingo Santana, or like Dan Vogelbach. I think you could even call Marco Gonzalez sort of a post-hype sleeper at this point in his career. And those guys are getting opportunities, and at least for the moment, playing well. And I think if you're going to rebuild, I would rather see like a churn of new players. Like, you know, give seven Domingo Santanas a chance and two or three of them will turn into guys who are contributors on the next good Mariners team.
It's a great point. And I think that even players where we maybe expected them to be up sooner rather than later, who have, it looks like are going to stick around in the minors for a little bit. Like, J.P. Crawford had a bad spring. There's definitely a service time element to their decision to have him down, but he also had a bad spring. But you expect that he'll be up and sort of get to have reps, and we'll see if, you know, they can rehabilitate any of that, you know, sort of prospect type that he once had. So I think that you're right to say that there is sort of an everyday opportunity for a lot of these guys. And it's resulting in a team that, like, I don't expect to win 90 games, but isn't going to be the Orioles either. And so I think, you know, it's different than some of those really intense losing teams that the Astros had in that respect, and that this is going to look like serviceable baseball. There are going to be times where this doesn't look all that different from the baseball the Mariners played when they were trying to win. But It does allow you to sort of enjoy and future cast on some of the guys who might be on the roster when they look to be good again. And also, you know, not resent the fact that they are often going to be the last game of the day on. So that part's good.
I think another important thing about that from a fan perspective is in baseball, at least, you know, I have obviously rooted for the tankingest basketball team in the history of basketball tanking, and it sucked. But like the difference between the first pick in the draft and even like the fifth pick in the draft in the NBA is gigantic, whereas it doesn't really matter that much in baseball. So like you can root for your team to win 75 games instead of 60, and it won't, like, you don't really have to worry about draft position, because scouting and what you do in terms of moving bonus money around matters so much more than strict draft order than baseball. The draft is just so unpredictable. So I don't know. Like, if this were a basketball podcast, I would be asking if you were worried about the Mariners screwing up their rebuild, but there really isn't that kind of concern here.
Oh, to be clear, I'm tremendously concerned about them screwing up their rebuild, because I have been a Mariners fan my whole life.
Okay. So for other reasons, not
but
because
for other reasons. Yeah. Right. Yes. It is less about any particular thing that they are doing in this moment and more about, my creeping existential dread and other aspects of my life. But, But yeah, it is. It does suggest that there is a plan and that the organization is sort of all rowing in the same direction, which at various points in the past has not always been clear. And so I think in that respect, it is much less concerning. And then, you know, if when this team is bad in May, everyone will turn their attention to the guys in the farm system who are really going to be what determines whether this team is good again and in playoff contention in a couple of years. And so you'll get that sort of balance also, which, you know, it's fun in its own way. So
before we go, I want to, while we have these precious moments where the Mariners are putting up weird statistical anomalies, this is like, for as much as I gripe about not knowing anything because of small sample size in the first month of the season, like, we get stuff like, for instance, I'm just going to run down a few of these. Jay Bruce through 12 team games has 8 hits, 1 single, 1 double, and 6 home runs. And this is just hilarious to me.
That's delightful.
Domingo Santana has 19 RBI in 12 games.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
Dan Vogelbach, who you mentioned before, has 5 home runs and 24 plate appearances.
And a 432 WRC plus.
That's pretty good. And Tim Beckham, the aforementioned Tim Beckham, has just been traded. And like you said, has been hitting like Barry Bonds, 400, 489, 825 with 5 errors. So yep. It's like if you put Barry Bonds at shortstop, it's great.
Yeah. In fairness to Tim, 3 of those were in the same inning. I get, you know, that can also be used as a negative.
Is that a good thing?
Pleasure.
Is that like a mitigating?
They still managed to win that game.
This wasn't the same game where Dylan Moore committed three errors in the ninth
inning. And yeah, that was a different game. That was against the Red Sox. That inning resulted, the Mariners did manage to win that game, but those errors led to Nick Rumbelo facing JD Martinez in a 1-run game with runners on. So that was a stressful moment for a lot of people. I would imagine Nick Rumbelo and Dylan Moore chief among them, but for many people across the Northwest as well. Can I tell you my favorite weird little stat? This comes courtesy of Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times, who said, tweeted that, so the Mariners have 32 home runs. They've hit 32 home runs so far. Last season, the Mariners hit their 32nd home run on April 28th, which was 26 games into their season.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you think the name change of the stadium, first of all, you said T-Mobile Park, which credit to you. I put the over-under on when I stopped calling it Safeco in like 2026.
I made a conscious effort when I was at T-Mobile Park on that day. I would have to check the transcript, but I cannot imagine that I had that kind of name fidelity. It's very disconcerting. It's super confusing. I don't like it. It's looked that way since it's opened, and now it's pink everywhere. I don't mind the pink, but it's just it's a lot to change. You know, we've officially moved out of the era of Mariners baseball that was defined by like the 2001 All-Star Game aesthetic, which is fine because, you know, that was a long time ago and this team's in a very different spot. But yeah, it was strange to have it be pink.
I think the pink actually is really good branding because I still call the Giants Stadium Pac Bell in my head, even though it hasn't been called that. This is what, like 4 names ago and like 15 years, but
it's Oracle now.
I couldn't tell you, honestly. I 100% could not tell you what their stadium is called, because it's been SBC and it's been, what was it, AT&T for a while, right? I don't know if this was a joke or not, but I read when they were building it that Ralph Lauren put in a token bid for the naming rights to try to call it the Polo Grounds.
That's delightful.
I want this to be true, even though I have no idea if it is or not. But anyway, Safeco, like you said, has such a specific look to it, you know, and all the pink is reminding me that it stands out so much from the blue. I think it looks good, you know, corporate branding though it may be.
Yeah.
But it's that, if not for that, then I would probably never stop calling it Safeco. Which I imagine they took into account when they were re-signing the place, when T-Mobile was putting up its signage.
I was hoping that Rainier Beer would come in as the naming
Rainier Beer.
You know, Anheuser now, so they have the money, and then they could have been Rainier Field, which would have been, you know, felt a little less brandy. But I think with the actual Rainiers so close at hand, that was probably a non-starter.
Yeah, that almost feels sort of Trojan horsey, like Great American Ballpark.
Yeah,
I remember being so excited that they were calling it that, and then finding out it was like an insurance firm or something.
Yeah.
What a bummer that was. Like, just just name it after a bank, you know.
Yeah.
Let's dispense with the charade. Okay. Well, this is our 20 minutes on the Mariners. Well, I guess 11 minutes on the Mariners and 7 minutes on corporate synergy. But, you know, this is we have done what the people asked. So, Meg, thanks for joining me and giving the people what they want.
Thanks for having me. Always happy to.
All right. So for our final segment, it is a maxim that you don't know anything about baseball until what? Memorial Day, right, Ben? Something like that?
Yeah, something like that. We're not even close.
Yeah, no, we're not even close. But at the same time, we've had almost 2 weeks of action and we have information that we didn't have at the start of the season. So I thought it might be useful to see, to sort of reevaluate certain of our preseason assumptions. You know, what things that maybe we feel like we were wrong about before, or things that were predictions that were based on a state of reality that doesn't exist anymore, or things that we thought would happen but wouldn't happen quite to this extent. And I thought the perfect man for this segment is somebody who will never admit he's wrong before Memorial Day, and that is Ben Lindbergh. Ben.
I'll admit I'm wrong before the season starts. That's how unseriously I take my predictions. But I will not usually change my predictions this quickly into a season because there just hasn't been enough to sway me, really. But there has been some action. And so we can at least come up with some confirmation bias examples of things that we've seen that made us think, oh, yeah, that's kind of what we thought, or this is different from what we thought. So I do have a few of those, at least. I'm trying to play a along here.
So we're not admitting we're going to do what I've learned over the years of podcasting with you is you will do things you don't like if we frame it as a draft. So we're going to do a quick draft over the next few minutes of things that we have in some way changed our opinion about since opening day, whether it's, you know, I've got one that I was just wrong about. But there are a couple others that, like, I thought this would happen, but wow, it's happening way more than I expected. Or, you know, I saw something coming and now it's here right in your face. So I guess I'll go first and admit that I picked the Los Angeles Angels to make the playoffs, and that is probably not going to happen. So this was sort of a stretch pick anyway. I looked at the roster and I was down there a lot during spring training trying to this is another thing I was wrong about. I was trying to write about what the Angels can do to contend before Mike Trout leaves via free agency. That premise is obviously no longer valid. But in talking to these guys, they seemed very confident, very, you know, in a good frame of mind, particularly after a tough season last year. And, you know, talking to, you know, I think it was Cole Calhoun said to me, like, everybody was hurt. Like, we had a lot of good players and they all got hurt, and that's probably not going to happen again. And I said, yeah, you're right. And guess what? They're all hurt again. Justin Upton is out with turf toe. Andrew Haney's never come back. Shohei Ohtani's not back yet. Keenan Middleton's not back. Zach Cozart's hurt again, although I don't know how hard that or how much time he's going to miss. Mike Trout is having the best season of his life so far, which is really saying something. By extension, it's like the best season of anybody's life except for Barry Bonds and Babe Ruth. But that's not enough to get them out of the basement. Right now, they're 5-6, and they've had to really get up off the mat to get there. I think that, but this is a situation where the idiom of about you can't win the pennant in April, but you can lose it.
Right.
Really comes into play, because this is a team that really needed everything to go right. And they just dug themselves a big enough hole in the first week of the season that it contrasts that to a team like the Red Sox. I think the Red Sox are 5 games better than the Rays throughout the rest of the season. But the Angels really needed to take advantage of the Astros slow start and get out to a lead and build themselves a cushion, and they didn't. And at this point, you know, maybe this is a little too reflexive, too pessimistic, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I approach this exercise more along the lines of things that have happened really quickly that maybe we thought would happen, but didn't expect to manifest themselves so soon. But if you wanted to look for something that I've actually changed my mind about, again, it's difficult because we just haven't seen a whole lot of the season
yet.
Yeah,
I know. I know.
I think, just insert that standard caveat in front of everything I say. But the closest I could come to maybe changing one of my preseason picks is the Cubs, just because I picked them to win the NL Central and I expected the NL Central to be extremely close, and I still do. And the Cubs are off to a 3-7 start. And as you said, you can maybe lose a division in April. And I don't know that they've gotten to that point yet. But if you look at Fangraphs playoff odds, for instance, the Cubs are the team that has lost the most ground since opening day. Just in terms of their chances to make the division series, they're down more than 20%, which is more than any other team. Every other team is down less than that. The Red Sox are really the only team that's even in that neighborhood. So if you buy into that, then you say, well, this division was always going to be extremely tight. There weren't going to be many games separating the best team from the next best team. And now the Cubs are 3-7, and they've had some worrisome signs. Some of it might be fleeting, but other things like Yu Darvish not looking like himself, maybe that's concerning in a way that at times during the spring, people thought he looked really good and might be back to form. And now that does not appear to be the case. So little things like that might make you flip-flop on them because they're just other really good teams in this division. And the Brewers are off to a good start. The Cardinals are really good. There just wasn't much daylight between the Cubs and the next best team. And based on these starts, maybe that's enough to switch to someone else if I were predicting today. I'd probably still take the Cubs as the best team in this division. But since I wouldn't have expected them to win by much, maybe they've already dug themselves enough of a hole not to be the favorites.
So this was going to be my next pick, and for the reasons that that you were talking about, with, you know, something that I thought was going to happen, but I didn't think it was going to happen this much or this quickly. Because I saw a lot of downside with this team. They're incredibly talented. This is, on paper, they might be as good as the team that won the World Series. Like, they've got a lot of the same players, and they're all still in their primes, and they haven't played that badly top to bottom. But there are two things that can happen in the first couple weeks that that would make me reconsider my preseason prediction. One is just the standings change; just they lose a lot of games, and this is what this is part of what I was talking about with the Angels, where like now you're starting from, you know, you needed to outperform your expectations by like five games to make the playoffs. And if you start in a three game hole and you have less time to make it up, obviously that's going to make it a lot less likely that you make the playoffs. And, you know, I think they're better than 3-7. They've played better than 3-7. But the other thing, you know, certainly their offense has played better than 3-7. But now John Lester's going to miss a start. And he's been the only pitcher who's really shown up for them this year. And they were relying on a lot of guys like Darvish coming back from injury, and then guys like Hamels and Hendricks, who are finesse pitchers at this point in their careers, they just haven't looked, they haven't been that sharp. And, you know, maybe that's just early season kinks, but like the longer it takes for those things to iron themselves out, it's going to be harder for the Cubs, who I didn't think were going to make the playoffs anyway, to really climb back up that hill. So I think that there's this is maybe a little bit harsh, but I think they've dug themselves in a non-trivial hole in the standings. But also, I am not that optimistic about them talent-wise as I was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and you were already lower on them than I was, right? It sounds like.
But I would not have, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised. I wouldn't have been surprised if, like you said, they had won the division. Like, that's how stacked the NL Central is. So that was my second. That would have been my second pick. What else do you have?
Well, I wanted to mention some of the bullpen implosions that we've seen thus far. I look at the bottom of the leaderboards at FanGraphs in terms of bullpen WAR and also bullpen win probability added. that's kind of considering the context and the timing and just considering the performance independent of timing. And there are some bullpens that we were all worried about coming into the year that have performed down to expectations so far. So you have the Braves, who are 28th in bullpen WAR and 25th in bullpen win probability added. You have the Nationals at 19th in WAR and 28th in WPA. And then you have the team we were just talking about, the Cubs, at 23rd in WAR and 30th dead last in WPA. And now, not everything has gone according to expectations. The Red Sox bullpen, for instance, has been fine, has not been their problem. Other things have been their problem. And I don't want to make too much of 2 weeks of bullpen performance, because bullpen performance is unpredictable to begin with, even over a full season. So 2 weeks is nothing.
But definitely know that as somebody who thought Trevor right. Rosenthal was going to be fine this year.
Yeah, I mean, Rosenthal's the most visible example of this, I think. But these were all teams either without the shutdown guy at the back of the pen, or just without enough bridges to the shutdown guy that you could be confident in the pen. And they've all sort of shown their weaknesses. And so these are three contenders. And obviously the Braves have been connected to Craig Kimbrel, and maybe that will continue. The Nationals have had bullpen problems year after year, even though they've been pretty active and tried to rebuild their bullpen. They have rebuilt it. It just hasn't been a whole lot better anyway. And then you have the Cubs, which has just been a disaster bullpen-wise so far. And if you're going to be bad at something, it's probably best to be bad at the bullpen, just because A, that can just kind of correct itself, and B, you can just find guys. You can just pull someone off a scrap heap or sign someone who throws hard and get a couple good months or convert a starter or something. It's easier to find a good reliever than it is to find a good starting position player, let's say. But all these teams, that seemed like possible Achilles heels for them, and so far that has been borne out.
The Nationals are just so confusing to me, because this is a we were talking about this on Slack. Maybe I don't remember if you were involved in this conversation, but I know Bobby was talking about this, that like their bullpen's been bad forever, and they've tried to fix it. They've made trades, like, and even when like the one reliable reliever they've had since like rookie Drew Storen is Sean Doolittle. And in order to get him, they had to give up Jesus Luzardo, who's turned into the best left-handed pitching prospect in baseball, Sheldon Noisy, who's a pretty good infield prospect, and Blake Treinen, who figured out, you know, figured his shit out and became the best relief pitcher in baseball last year. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, from a process standpoint, this has got to be so incredibly frustrating, because like you said, these guys can just, Lou Trevino can just pop up out of nowhere, add seven miles an hour to his fastball, and become like 1996 Mariano Rivera out of nowhere. And if that just doesn't happen, like, obviously there are coaching and player development and scouting principles beyond what we can see from the outside that are at work here, but without having access to that black box, and maybe even if you do have access, it's just mystifying. How this works out for some teams, but not for others. And I thought, you know, Rosenthal was pretty good. He had struggled in 2016, but he had gotten his closer role back. He was pitching well when he blew out his elbow 2 years ago. He comes back, he's throwing 99, and it's just not there. You know, Tony Sipp had a rough go of it. Matt Grace, who's been, you know, both Sipp and Grace have been effective as relief pitchers in years past, and it's just not working for the Nationals right now. And if I were Mike Rizzo, I would lose sleep over this.
Yeah. A few other things that have stood out to me in the first couple of weeks. A, Luis Severino is someone who I think was a pivotal player in the AL East. He's a guy that I think really separated the Yankees potentially from the Red Sox and the Rays, and his injury in spring training really took them down a peg. And at the time, it looked like rotator cuff inflammation. Now, anything that starts with rotator cuff is just automatically scary, but inflammation didn't sound serious, and there was some expectation that he might be back. He was progressing through his long toss program. Everything seemed to be going swimmingly. And then just this week, he experienced a setback. He felt some discomfort while he was throwing. He's gone back to New York for an MRI, and Yankees fans are waiting with bated breath as we record to find out the prognosis. But that's the sort of thing where he signed an extension, one of those sort of below market extensions this spring. And you think, well, why did these guys sign these extensions? And this is an example of why, because if you're a pitcher, you can suddenly hurt your shoulder and who knows when you'll be good again or back again at all. So there's still hope, obviously, as we speak, but anytime you have a shoulder injury, it's concerning. And he's such a key to their staff. I mean, their bullpen is so good that I think they can weather this anyway. But if you were to come up with a scenario where the Yankees unravel, it is Severino missing.
It starts here.
A big chunk of the season, maybe someone else, perhaps your friend James Paxton going and getting hurt also.
That would never happen. I don't know what you're talking about.
It could potentially happen. So that's sort of scary. And that setback that you always worry about with shoulder injuries that has struck. So that's one thing that stands out to me. Another is that we were all talking in the spring, just from an entertainment perspective, from an ethical perspective, but also from a competitive perspective about how it makes sense to promote your best prospects, even if you could potentially game their service time. And we've seen a couple teams benefit from that already. Mm-hmm. Pete Alonso, of course, who you have just written an ode to. He has been the big beefy slugger that Mets fans have been waiting for. They're off to a good start in part because of him. Fernando Tatis has also launched a few homers. He's looked good for the Padres, who are off to a good start themselves. I guess Eloy Jimenez is the exception. He has looked a little overmatched so far. I wouldn't really expect
that to
continue.
It's also not exactly the same because they got him to sign the extension.
Right. So. Yeah, exactly. So they kind of, you know, manipulated him into that perhaps, mm-hmm. but that took away the incentive to keep him down. But the teams that have said, okay, we're going to go for it. Chris Paddock too. Yeah. So the teams that have said, you know what, we're just going to put our best players on the active roster to start the season. What a novel concept. They have benefited from that. And those guys have shown that they're ready. Whereas, you know, that if the teams had made a different decision, they would have made some excuse and constructed some argument for why those players weren't ready. And of course they are. And they're showing that so far. So that's another one that stands out to me.
And like the guys who have been held down, like mm-hmm. Nick Senzel and Vlad Guerrero Jr. have been hurt. And so like the counter argument is weakened in that respect. So like that big hysterical, I mean, it wasn't hysterical. It was righteous, but it looks hysterical now after we've seen the way the first couple weeks of the season have played out. And, you know, I hope that's the way it goes going forward. You know, I mm-hmm. hope I don't have to write that again next year, but we'll see.
And two other things. One you alluded to, it seems that Mike Trout has leveled up again. And I'm just wondering how long I have to wait before I can write my annual spring post about how Mike Trout got better again, because seemingly he does improve year after year, even though he's already the best player ever, perhaps at least to this point in his career. He is on something like an 18 war pace right now, which I know it's ridiculous. Not even Mike Trout can do that, but he's just not striking out anymore. He's walking a ton. He's hitting for a lot of power. He's robbing other MVPs of home runs. He's just been incredible. And the contrast between him and the rest of the Angels has never been stronger than it is right now, because you were just talking about the Angels may already be playing themselves out of the playoff picture. And Mike Trout is the exception to that. He is just a superhero among mortals in this lineup right now.
I was going to give you one more. The Phillies and Mets lineups, I thought both of them would be a lot deeper than, you know, obviously the Phillies, you know, what do you think? Like four of their five, six best hitters are new to the team this year. I underestimated how big an impact that would be.
Yeah.
I thought they would score runs. I didn't realize how relentless that would feel to watch. Mm-hmm. And I think the Mets, to a certain extent, bringing up Alonso, bringing in Robinson Cano, having Brandon Nimmo and Michael Conforto and Jeff McNeil, who can rake, apparently. Wilson Ramos, new to the team as well. Putting those guys all in the same lineup, it's just one guy after another who can hit the ball hard. And I thought that, I don't know if like from a production standpoint, I underestimated how much better those teams would be offensively, but from a perception standpoint, like it definitely, like seeing it all on the field has been, it's been revelatory, would say, is the word.
Yeah, I picked the Phillies to win that division, and I sort of second-guessed myself when I did that because I'm always wary of picking the team that won the offseason. Mm-hmm. I think when a team makes a bunch of flashy moves over the winter, it can be really easy to get seduced by that and overlook some of the flaws that are still on the roster. But when
still
I look down...
Still not sold on the back end of that rotation.
Sure, yeah, that's still a concern. But when I look down the projected lineup in the spring, it was just, I mean, almost every guy is good and is dangerous. And that just seemed to me like enough to set them apart. And so far that has been the case. So my last thing that I wanted to mention, I do a check-in at the end of spring training every year, just about what the spring stats can tell us about what the regular season stats might look like, because individual players' spring stats are obviously pretty unreliable, except at the extremes. But you can look at league-wide strikeout rates and home run rates and that sort of thing and get a pretty good indication of what's going to happen in the regular season. And based on this spring, there was no sign at all that the strikeouts and the three true outcomes had abated. Everything had increased again, at least very slightly. And it doesn't actually take that long to see that show up in the regular season. And so right now we are at a 22.9% strikeout rate. That is up 0.6 percentage points from last year's all-time high. And the three true outcomes rate has actually taken a large leap up to 35.7%. It was at 33.8%. So that's the percentage of plate appearances that end in a home run, strikeout, or walk. And we've seen strikeouts go up, we've seen walks go up, and we've seen lots and lots of dingers. So home runs seem to, at least in the early going, be back to 2017 record type levels. So as I wrote in the spring, if you don't care for strikeout and homer and three true outcome heavy baseball, you are out of luck.
Yeah, it's a bummer as somebody who would like to see the ball get put in play a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's the baseball I've got to watch. So I'm going to put a smile on, just as you have for doing this segment, whose premise you don't entirely disagree or you don't entirely agree with. So I appreciate you humoring me and putting in some effort this time.
Yeah, we negotiated the premise. We found a common ground that was acceptable to both of us.
But next week, we'll have enough data to draw sweeping conclusions, right?
Right. Yes, of course.
Okay, so next week, sweeping conclusions after the first 3 weeks of the season, and I'll talk to you again then.
Talk to you then.
That'll just about do it for this week's edition of the Ringer MLB Show. Thanks to Zach and Ben for joining me as always, and a special thanks to our special guest, Meg Rowley from Fangraphs. Thanks to Bobby Wagner for producing today's show. Thanks to Chris Sale, Tim Beckham, and Mike Trout for giving us stuff to talk about. And I'd like to take some time out for a special mention for Blue Jays catcher Max Pentecost, who has retired from baseball. I think I speak for everyone at the Ringer in wishing the former Kennesaw State legend the best in his future endeavors. And thank you for listening. Enjoy the week's action, and we'll see you next time.